Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them. And the Lord said unto Satan, Whence comest thou? And Satan answered the Lord and said, From going to and from the earth, and from walking up and down in it. And the Lord said unto Satan, Hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, Doth Job fear God for naught? Hast thou not made an edge about him, about his house, and about all that he hath on every side? Hast thou blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land? Put forth thine hand now, and touch all that he hath, and he will curse thee to thy face. And the Lord said unto Satan, Behold, all that he hath is in thy power, only upon himself put not forth thine hand. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. This morning we're thankful to have with us Elder John Miller from the Saratoga Seventh-day Adventist Church, and he will be bringing the day's message.
Triumph over tragedy. Tweety, the canary, never saw it coming. He was in his cage, whistling a happy tune. Then his owner, Granny, decided that she would clean his cage. She took out the vacuum, turned it on, and began suctioning some of the feathers and the seeds at the bottom of his cage. Then the telephone rang. She turned her head for an instant, and in that moment in time, Tweety was sucked through the vacuum cleaner hose into the bag and ended up a big, furry gray dust ball. Granny, with a sense of urgency, opened up the bag, found that big gray dust ball, took him out, went over to the sink, turned on the faucet. Out came a torrent of cold water. Granny was relieved that the dust was gone. What tore Tweety was there shivering from head to toe. Frantically, she went, got the hairdryer, switched it to its highest setting, turned it on, and Tweety was hit with a hurricane of hot air. But he was dry. Did he survive? Yes, he did. But every time that Tweety sees the vacuum cleaner, he looks somewhat askance, and he doesn't seem to sing quite as often. Sucked in, washed up, and blown over. At some point, it happens to all of us. If it hasn't happened to you yet, it will at some time. Unfortunately, it's not just cartoon characters that face difficulties. I think we can all remember 9/11, the tsunami, Hurricane Katrina. Not only do those things happen now, but going back thousands of years ago to a man named Job. If you look at Job chapter 1, verse 3, I believe, it indicates how much he had. Verse 2, 7 sons, 3 daughters, 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 donkeys, and a large number of servants. Back in his day, he was probably the richest person around. If you turn to chapter 29, verse 11 through 16, Job states about himself, whoever heard me spoke well of me, and those who saw me commended me, because I rescued the poor who cried for help, the fatherless who had none to assist them. The man who was dying blessed me. I made the widow's heart sing. I put on righteousness as my clothing. Justice was my robe and my turban. I was the eyes to the blind, the feet to the lame, the father to the needy. I took up the case of the stranger. And if you read on that same chapter from verses 21 through 25, Job talks further about himself. And from those verses, you can see that he had a pretty high opinion of himself. It's one thing to think highly about yourself. It's quite another when God thinks highly of you. If you go to Job 1:8, then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. And some, one could think of Job as an amalgamation between Bill Gates and Mother Teresa. After God pointed out Job's righteousness, Satan challenged God. He said that Job was only faithful because God blessed him. Satan accused Job of being a fair-weather friend to God. Send a storm in his life, God, he'll drop you like a hot potato. So God allowed disaster to come upon Job. In one day, he lost his material possessions, his servants, and every one of his 10 children. Despite these tragedies, the Bible tells us that Job remained faithful. Job 1:22, in all of this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. So we turn to chapter 2. The plot seems to repeat itself. The Lord points out the impeccable character of Job. And again, Satan is there to malign it. Job 2:5, but stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, and he will surely curse you to your face. This is the central issue of the book of Job. Will a human being maintain his relationship with God when he seemingly gets nothing in return? Is our loyalty, devotion, and trust on the Lord dependent upon the circumstances in our lives? Will our love for God remain intact when all the good things are stripped away. Love that has to be bought isn't love. It's bribery. Do you know that when the divorce rate rises, toy sales increase significantly, the parents and the grandparents vie for the children's affection by buying more toys. In essence, what Satan accused God of was bribery. Job had passed the first test and showed that he loved God even without his riches and even without his family. There's one area that he hadn't been tested in so far, and that was his health. Under the world's view, if you don't have your health, what do you have? God gave Satan permission to go and afflict Job with a dreadful disease. The only condition was that Satan spare his life. So Satan went out and afflicted Job with sores from his head to his toe. From other parts of Job, we learn there are other miserable parts to this disease. He had scabs and sores all over his body that cracked and oozed. They were infected with worms. He had fevers and chills, shriveled skin, diarrhea, sleeplessness, delirium, and excruciating pain throughout his entire body. From Job's perspective, there's little hope of recovery. His wife recognized that too. She was spared by Satan for a reason. She made an awful suggestion to her husband. She said, "Are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die." She told him two things. First, to abandon his faith. And then secondly, she suggested that he commit suicide. "Curse God to your face so that he will kill you and you'll get it over with." She had been suffering right along with her husband. She had lost all her children, possessions, and livelihood. And now her husband was a repulsive mass of oozing sores. She had no one to hold on to, no one to comfort her. From her point of view, if there was a God, he surely didn't deserve her faith. Job's response to her was, "You are talking as a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? And all of this." Job did not sin. Now, three friends of Job enter upon the scene: Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. What kind of an impact did they have on him? At the inception of their vision, they were a comfort. It says when they arrived in verse 12 of chapter 2 that they could hardly recognize him. Job looked so bad that they reacted as people in mourning. He began to weep aloud. They tore their clothes and their robes, sprinkled their heads with dust. For 7 days and 7 nights, no one said a word to him because they saw how great his suffering was. If the story ended there, I will tell you that these friends were great friends indeed. Job's friends heard him curse the day of his birth, and then they began to give him what they perceived to be his wise counsel. Eliphaz started out, "Think now, who that was ever innocent ever perished? Or when were the upright cut off? As I have seen those who plow iniquity and sow trouble weep the same." In other words, trouble comes to those who sin, but the innocent do not perish. In essence, he's saying that suffering is the result of sin, and prosperity the result of righteousness. He goes on to acknowledge that all men are sinners in 4:17, and that some suffering is loving chastising of God, chapter 5, verse 17. Unfortunately, the application he makes of his theology is insensitive and superficial. He insinuates that Job hasn't really sought God the way that he should, and tells him, just commit to the Lord and your fortune will be restored. Job knew it was too simple a response because it didn't answer the hard questions. It doesn't answer why some people suffer in an extraordinary way, even though they haven't sinned in an extraordinary way, while others prosper immensely, while they sin greatly. Job protests his innocence. "I have not denied the words of the Holy One," he challenges. He says, "Teach me, and I will be silent. Make me understand how I have erred." Then Bildad takes up the gauntlet. He begins less gently than Eliphaz. He insists on Eliphaz's principle of justice and says, "Job, your children are guilty of some unknown sin. That's why their houses were crushed." Job 8, 4 through 6. Then Bildad accuses Job of backsliding in 11 and 20 of that same chapter. Job reiterates his innocence, and Eliphaz again accuses him more harshly, rebukes him for not admitting his sin. Job replies that his friends' maxims are Proverbs of Ashes, 13:12. That their advice is neither helpful nor insightful. And after this, a second round of speeches began, even more harshly than the first. "Eliphaz, but you even undermine piety and hinder devotion to God. Your sin prompts your mouth. You adapt the tongue of the crafty. Your own mouth condemns you, not mine. Your own lips testify against you." In essence, he's saying, "Listen to me, and I'll explain to you." Have you noticed sometimes that we seem to set ourselves up as the superior one, that Job is just what someone else needs to do? We always seem to be willing to be a teacher. You can learn a thing or two from us. I've been around the block a few times. and we start quoting the Bible. And if we don't know the Bible, some quote Oprah or Dr. Phil, and maybe we should be listening to what others are saying to us or what God's saying. Thereafter, again and again, Job's three friends insist that suffering follows weakness, wickedness, and it's the wicked derive in pain. Job defends himself that there's no evidence. That he sinned extraordinarily, and that the wicked often prosper and the righteous often suffer. Job's three friends aren't able to sustain their theory in the face of Job's integrity, and their speeches come to a close. And only Job is left speaking. He's shown that suffering cannot be explained by a simple principle of retributive justice when each gets what they deserved. But he's found no answer. Job's feeling that God is capricious and arbitrary. Job does not doubt that he rules the affairs of men wisely, but he wonders, why do the righteous suffer? And thus far, no one's given him an answer. It's possible for us to live our lives at this level of understanding. We can simply say, yes, I believe God rules the world and he controls what happens. I believe that he's just and I believe that he's wise. And I believe that though things look arbitrary and capricious in this life, that all things will be righted in heaven. At this point, a fourth friend arrives upon the scene, Elihu. He is angry at Job because Job has justified himself rather than God. And he's angry at Job's three friends because they have given Job no answer. Elihu looks at the groups of people, the rich and the righteous, and he distinguishes different roles for suffering in each of them. Job 36:6, he does not withdraw his eyes from the righteous, but enthrones them with kings and exalts them forever. Now, if he stopped at this point, he would have sounded like Eliphaz, the wicked suffer and the righteous prosper. And this is a sense that this is true in the long run. But the question plaguing Job is, why do the righteous suffer in the short run? Elihu goes on at 36:8, and if they, that's the righteous, are bound up in fetters and cords of affliction, i.e. they suffer, then God declares to them their works and their transgressions, that they are behaving arrogantly. He opens their ears in instruction and commands that they return from iniquity. According to Elihu, the purpose of Job's suffering was to purge out of Job's life a residue of pride. When Job had tried to justify himself at God's expense, as he finishes speaking, a thunderstorm gathers, and out of the whirlwind comes the voice of God. Who is it that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man, and I will question you, and you shall answer me. God has heard Job's questions long enough, and now he has some questions for Job. God questions Job about where he was when he laid the foundations of the earth, shut in the sea, established the days and nights, the snow, the rain, the hail. Where was he when he made the constellations? He made the birds and the other animals. Whether we focus on the earth or the sea, or the dawn of the constellations. The upshot is that Job is ignorant and impotent. He doesn't know where they came from. He doesn't know how to make them work. He is surrounded above and below by mysteries and things he does not understand. Sometimes people think because of the scientific advancements the last couple hundred years, from automobiles, planes, to computers, that we as humans know so much. But our knowledge, when compared to God's knowledge, is like a couple grains of sand dumped on an infinite beach. At the beginning of chapter 40, God pauses from his question and gives Job the chance to respond. 40 verse 2, "Will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer him." And then Job answers, "Lord, behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer thee? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once, and I will not answer twice." Job is now getting the point that he is a finite creature. He does not have the wisdom to run this world and is utterly ignorant of almost all of its processes, and that he has no business instructing his maker and his ruler how to run the world, nor condemning God for the way he runs it. During the remainder of chapter 40 and 41, God shows his might. It's not arbitrary, but purposeful. Therefore, Job should not presume to accuse God of being arbitrary or capricious. He should submit to the wisdom and the goodness of God's dealings and hold fast to the promises. Psalms 84:11, "God withholds no good thing from those who walk uprightly." Job 42, 1 through 6, Job bows reverently in submission to three great truths. He confesses that God is absolutely sovereign. "I know that thou can do all things, and that no purpose of thine can be thwarted." Secondly, he confesses the truth that God's wisdom makes his own look like ignorance. "I have uttered what I do not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know." Then in verse 6, he confesses that he unjustly spoke presumptuous words against God. "I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." Job is a changed man. That's what happens when you really see God. It happened to Isaiah. "Woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Isaiah 6:5. It happened to Peter when Jesus showed him his power. "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." Luke 5:8. It happened to the centurion when Jesus came to his house. "Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy to have you come under my roof." Luke 7:6. In the epilogue, God directs Eliphaz and his two friends to make a burnt offering and requests that Job pray for them as a result of their spiritual ignorance. God seeks to humble these three friends of Job by telling them that they are theologically wrong and makes them seek forgiveness through the very one that they criticized. God is seeking to it that the only way these friends can experience reconciliation with God through experiencing reconciliation with Job. They must humble themselves before Job. There's a second thing that God is doing. He's proving the repentance of Job. When the friends come to Job seeking his intercession with God, it's not just the humility of the friends that's on trial. Job is being asked to love and to pray for those that abused him. He's asking to bless those who criticized him, not return evil for evil. It's through repentance and faith that we receive the forgiveness of God. The genuineness of our repentance, the authenticity of our faith, the reality of our change of heart must prove itself in our willingness to forgive those who have sinned against us. If the forgiveness of God that a repentant sinner claims to have received does not flow to others, the claim is a delusion. So God put Job to one last test. Will he forgo revenge and accept the terms of God's treaty and extend amnesty to his friends? Job does. He passes the test. And the Lord blessed Job in the second part of his life more than the first. The book of Job reveals to us how to help others who are suffering and teaches us what not to do. We need to show love and compassion to the suffering and avoid being judgmental and overconfident in our own theology, as Job's friends were. It also shows that suffering is not necessarily punishment for sin. And it reminds us that God is always in control, for Satan was only able to afflict Job to the extent that God permitted it. God pointed out Job in the first place. He didn't do it to be mean. There's a purpose for every test that Job went through. Even after reading Job, while we may not be able to understand the whole reason for what Job went through, it gives us confidence because we know that God's promised a way through. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful and he will not let you be tempted beyond your strength. But the temptation will also provide you the way of escape that you may be able to endure to the end. 1 Corinthians 10:13. James 1, 2 and 3, consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trial of many kinds, because you know the testing of your faith develops perseverance. Perseverance must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking in anything. Suffering also gives us the ability to empathize with the pain of others. He comforts us in our troubles so that we may comfort others. When others are troubled, we will be able to give them the same comfort that God has given us. One of the ways that Job was able to deal with his trials was remembering how God had provided for him in the past. He had experienced God's goodness and mercy and knew that he could count on it in his future. Job 19:25. I know that my Redeemer lives and that in the end he will stand upon this earth. One of the episodes of the Andy Griffith Show, Opie tells his father about a new found friend named Mr. McVeevy. He tells him how he met him in the woods and that Mr. McVeevy came down from a tree, had a big shiny hat that jiggled, that he had 10 extra hands on his belt, and that he could make smoke come out of his ears. His father thought this was an imaginary friend. And one day, Opie brought home a hatchet. Said it was from Mr. McVeevy. And he told him to take it back. The next day, Opie brought home a quarter from his friend. His father asked where he got it from. Opie replied again, "Mr. McVeevy." In frustration, Andy sent him up to his room and then had a talk with him. Opie was either to admit that Mr. McVeevy was imaginary or he'd get a whipping. Opie looked his father in the eye and said, "He's real, Pa. Don't you believe me?" Andy stopped. He looked his son in the eye and, against his common sense, said, "Yes, I believe you, son." When Andy came downstairs, Barney asked him what happened. When Andy relayed the story to him, Barney replied, "Andy, you don't really believe in Mr. McVeevy, do you?" Andy's reply was classic. "No, Barney, I don't believe in Mr. McVeevy, but I do believe in Opie." He knew from the past that his son was not a liar. He trusted that no matter how ridiculous the story sounded, that his son was telling the truth. A while later, Andy went into the woods and, out of frustration, started yelling, "Mr. McVeevy! Mr. McVeevy!" To his surprise, a voice answered him, "Yes, I'll be right down." Mr. McVeevy was real. He worked for the Forestry Service, wore a hard hat, had a tool belt, and using a cigarette, he could make smoke come out of his ears. When the trials come, trust in your past with God and in the promises of God. Pain and suffering will come, and we can endure them with or without God. Hold on to God, even if you don't see a reason. A little girl named Diane was born to the Fox family in 1971. She had no eyelids, a cleft palate, a deformed face, a twisted arm, and a hole in her head that served as a face and mouth. She also had problems with her heart. Her parents were devastated and wondered if she would survive. Their doctor told them of a talented and experienced surgeon who could perform wonders over the course of time and many surgeries. At first, they were skeptical, but they decided to give the surgeon a chance. He repaired the hole in the girl's heart and gave her a mouth and a nose, straightened up her twisted arm and a club leg. Then there were more surgeries. And finally, she was just awaiting a new face. And at 12, she had that surgery, and her body was complete. The story of Diane Fox is representative of the sanctifying process that Jesus takes us all through as he tries to save us. Like Diane, we have all been deformed by sin. We're all wretched, blind, and naked until we find Jesus and he starts us on the path to heaven. Like Diane, God is daily working on us to make us what we ought to be, constantly chipping away at our characters in an effort to give us new hearts and eventually new bodies. Like the surgery that Diane went through, the process is often painful, but it is through the purifying flames of trial that we become more like Jesus. It was by enduring painful surgeries that Diane was healed. Jesus promised to give those who endure to the end a crown of life. It's by resting on his unchanging arms that we will find peace and safety from the storms of life. Like Diane Fox, we can't give up. We must trust Jesus that he'll be faithful and accomplish the things which he promised that he will. And through the purifying process, we will come out like pure gold. And like Jesus, and we'll receive the crown of the righteous in a spot in the kingdom of heaven.